all need those dollars for sure. We're going to try and help you get some more of them. 720 WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hanson in for John Williams. Fear not, Mr. Williams will be back tomorrow. Joining us now, John Najarian, who is, of course, well known as the founder of MarketRebellion.com. And John, I think we're in a little bit of a, what, a holding pattern, right? Waiting for stimulus news.
Indeed. And I think it's a huge mistake, regardless of which candidate we want to root for, if we don't get this stimulus, because I think it's kind of, John, equivalent of Lehman Brothers. When the Fed let Lehman fail, when the government together decided not to bail out those kinds of players, for instance, Bear Stearns or Lehman, it had effects that shook broadly the market. And if we don't get stimulus before the election, then I think we don't get it until March. And I've been saying this for a while because of how Congress gets seated and the president gets established into the office. That means that's a lot of time. That's 5+ months for people to basically say, well, I just can't make it, and I can't make it 5 months in my small business. So I really hope we get that done. I wish they had more of a critical look at what it does to people that they've basically taken their ability to earn away from them during this pandemic.
I have a complicated question I hope I answer in somewhat of a coherent form, so bear with me. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, you know, talking about getting this second wave under control. But it's not exactly cases go up, market goes down. At least it hasn't been so far. Is it because some of it has been baked in and a second wave just raises more uncertainty? I mean, there's no guarantee that cases go up, markets go down. We haven't seen that in the past. Is that what we're going to see in the future, I guess? I know that wasn't the best way to ask that question. I hope you can offer some clarity.
Well, a lot of us look through the numbers themselves and are looking at the morbidity or mortality and trying to see, okay, people will get this particular pathogen until we have a vaccine and or strong treatments. Now, on the other hand, if a 74-year-old guy like the president, who's not in the greatest shape, he does have some positives. He doesn't eat, he doesn't drink or smoke.
Right.
But nonetheless, he has some health conditions, and if he's able to recover as quickly as the medical folks tell us that he has, that is a good sign. So again, people getting it, John, is not nearly as bad as the people that get it. How deadly is it? And it seems that the doctor's ability, nurses and so forth, healthcare people, their ability to deal with this has improved dramatically over the 7 months that we've been dealing with it.
That's a really interesting point. Obviously, I think a healthy president helps markets in general because of uncertainty. You certainly don't wish the president ill will, no matter what you think of him politically. That's interesting, though, that his actual recovery ties to the idea that maybe as a country we're getting better at doing this. Of course, it's one case, but it's a very important one at that.
Right, and we'll have several others. And obviously, Chris Christie will be a very interesting one as well, because the former governor is definitely a lot more in danger than the president in terms of his physical makeup. And I think that, you know, so many of the staff that have come down with it, if virtually all of them recover with little additional underlying health issues from the from this pathogen, then that's going to be a big positive too.
Apple off of its lows. Seemingly they can always make an announcement and rely on a little bounce. That's what they're seeing a little bit here after an opening lower opening.
Yeah, well, they finally told us that the 13th, which is next week, of course, they're going to be presenting the a week from today, in fact, they're going to be presenting the 5G iPhone. And many of us think this is the upgrade that a lot of people have put off buying a new phone in anticipation of. And if I'm right about that, this could be one of the biggest launches ever for Apple. And thus the 13th, a pretty important date for Apple. And we'll see how much of the sell-off from 138 that it peaked at just a couple weeks ago, how much we can make up between 115 and 138. Those are prices, of course, where the stock was at 138. Now it's 115.
Yeah.
It's just down a buck today.
Yeah, after their split four ways earlier. Okay, what are you looking at here today? What tips you got for us here?
Well, we have strong buying in Facebook. We have also very strong buying in Peloton. You know, everybody loves those Peloton bikes, seemingly, and you can't get them. They're back-ordered for months, but nonetheless, they have reoccurring revenue that comes their way in the form of people signing up for classes so that they can join remotely, and that doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon, and we see big institutional buying in both those stocks, Facebook and Peloton. PTON.
And what's amazing, you may not be able to tell it, but John Najarian's been doing this whole interview during his Peloton workout. We appreciate that, John.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, John. Much appreciated.
John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com. Always great to chat with him. Okay, we're going to analyze your 401ks after this on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hansen in for John Williams. John Williams will be back tomorrow. And I'm joined now by James Royal, Bankrate.com analyst. James, talking about 401ks, and obviously this conversation depends a lot about how soon you are to retirement, how far you are from it. But I guess the most important thing is to have important conversations about your 401k. Because while you want to leave it alone a bit, it can be a useful tool for you, but you can mess it up a lot if you're not paying close attention.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. I think especially in times like this, where we've seen lots of ups and downs in the market, it's important just to check in on your long-term plan, make sure it still fits your needs, and to see if there's maybe a little, you know, a few tweaks that you need to make here and there.
James, can you remind us what the CARES Act allowed people to do with their 401ks?
Right. So the big thing basically is the government wanted people who really needed access to some of that 401k money to access it without that bonus, 10% bonus penalty. So if you've been affected in some way by COVID, basically the government lets you take out that money without that 10% bonus penalty. Now, again, that doesn't get you away from any taxes that you might owe on the earnings. So there's still some hit there, or mm-hmm. could be some hit there.
My question is, how long is that in place for? Because let's say someone out there has been okay, they've kept their jobs, but maybe a layoff is coming in November or December, God forbid. How long is the CARES Act giving us to do that?
Sure, right. And it's right now it's only through the end of the year. You have to make that withdrawal by the end of the year. Otherwise, you don't know what Congress might do after that.
Yeah. I don't know what Congress is going to do tomorrow, let alone at the end of the year or next. So I know a lot of people, you know, analyzing their 401k. It's always a difficult thing to do. You know, the markets went down to about 18,000. You know, common wisdom was, oh, you make it really aggressive right now, then buy. I mean, this is hard stuff to do. What is your general thoughts for people who are looking to maybe tinker with where their investments are allocated?
Yeah, so one of the big things, advisors typically recommend that you find a long-term allocation that sort of fits your temperament and your time until you need that money, right? Your time until retirement. So, for example, if you have a 70% allocation to stocks, 30% to bonds, one of the things that you might have been able to do when the market dipped, right, you saw stocks dip a lot, bonds dip not so much, and so you pour a little bit of that bond allocation into stocks when they're down, and perhaps vice versa when stocks outperform. So I think the big thing, however, is really finding that long-term plan and then that long-term allocation and then sticking to that, right? So that the important thing is really to not deviate from a plan that's going to be successful in the long term, get scared out of the market because stocks are down.
In normal roller coaster times, which happens, of course, the ups and the downs, we're all used to that, I think sticking with the plan makes sense and is easy. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense now. I guess what I'm saying is I can understand why, boy, we've used the word unprecedented more in 2020 than any other time before, why people would be spooked out of it. But I guess what your analysis would be, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's been other unprecedented times that if you stuck with the plan, you win in the long run.
Right. I think that's absolutely correct. You know, the time from 2000 to 2010 was one of the worst decades for the S&P 500 in a long time. Basically, flat returns, right? But if you were adding throughout that decade, as investors in 401ks do, right? They have money pulled from their paycheck every 2 weeks. Right. If you've been buying at the lows of 2002, 2003, as the market started to rebound in 2004, you were not down zero. You were not flat over that decade, right? Mm-hmm. And as we saw in 2008, 2009 bear market, stocks were down about 50% high to low.
Mm. I wanted to ask, how do you know if your 401k is too aggressive or too conservative? A lot of it, again, is going to depend how close you are to retirement. But like you mentioned, that it might be too aggressive if your account balances fluctuate a lot. Yeah, but the market does too. So what's the best way to compare your 401k plan to other plans out there or to the market in general to make a real determination if it's fluctuating too much or if it's just fluctuating based on what the market's doing in general?
So I'll give you a rule of thumb, but I do want to stress the point that you've made, right, is that it really depends a lot on when you need to tap that money. What makes sense for a 65-year-old, which is to be more conservative, have a higher bond allocation than a stock allocation, is absolutely not what makes sense for a 25 or 35-year-old with, you know, literally decades before they need to tap that money. They can ride out that stock market volatility and get better returns. But that said, a useful way to think about this is what's called the rule of 100, right, where you subtract your age from 100 to get your allocation to stocks. So, for example, somebody at 65 might have 35% in stocks and then 65% in bonds. And so that gives you at least a little more of an absolute standard about where you might want to be. And you can adjust from there. If you want to be a little more conservative, then you can have more bonds.
Mm-hmm.
I would say though, you know, if you're at, let's say 65, your retirement age, 67, you do need, to continue to have some growth in that portfolio, right? And that's something that stocks can provide. You might need that money for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. And if you have a spouse that's younger than you, they might need that money, right, even longer. And so it's important to have some of the growth. And so, for example, with the rule of 100, even at 65, you've still got 35% in stocks. And that provides that growth component that you will need over time.
James, I got to tell you about the cruelest game I ever get to play. I use retirement calculators, and it asks you, how long do you think you'll live for? And I think optimistically, I'm like, you know, let's throw 100 in there. And then I realize I'm falling short. So I'm like, you know, let's just knock a few years off this. And then it's like I hit 90 and I'm okay. And I'm like, all right, we'll settle for that.
Yeah, you really don't want to outlive your income,
yeah.
Right? That's not a favorable place to be. And more so, with Social Security now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's not very far off where they're projecting significant cuts, right? 25%, right now projections, for 2035 at 25% cut, to payments that everybody is receiving. So, you really do have to think ahead here.
Is it a safe bet if you are in that maybe under 50 age and you're analyzing your 401k to just put a zero in additional income and plan for that?
At this point, it's really difficult to say what's going to – back to Congress again, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult to say how they're going to shore this up, if they're going to shore it up. But I think really you have to err on the side of caution that they may not do the right thing here. And that means you probably need to be more aggressive in your own portfolio, right? You need to save a little bit more every year.
Going back to the 401ks for a second, what are your thoughts on those? And this is what I have, the target retirement date account. I know people go back and forth on that. It at least certainly changes your allocations. If I say 2055, as I get closer in theory, it's going to be moving it to be more conservative as I go along. Can I trust that to do it? Should I be today paying a little bit more attention?
So, great question. Target date funds are fantastic precisely because you put in the period, the time, the year when you need that money, or when you start to tap that money, and then the target date fund just sort of moves it over from an aggressive allocation to a more conservative allocation. So that's great. If there's some potential downside is that it might end up being more conservative than what you need. I've spoken with financial advisors who recommend, hey, take a target date that's 5 or 10 years further out than when you're actually going to need the money, because it'll be a little bit more aggressive for longer, and that's going to help your overall returns. And then it helps you, of course, later in retirement as well, where you have that growthy component further on into your retirement.
Yeah, I think one of the important things that you brought up here is that retirement is not the end of the line in terms of the finish line. You want to be prepared for that moment so you have money, but that money can still grow, so you still have to be paying attention to it well after retirement, too.
Absolutely. Yeah,
for sure. All right, James, thanks so much for your time. James Arroyo from Bankrate.com, really dissecting our 401ks. I feel I should just send him all my information right now. James, you want to do a full look at mine and give me the prognosis?
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thanks so much.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much, James. Okay. John Hanson here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here is what we got coming up. Good news for Chicago. Not a lot of tourism going around or people traveling too much, certainly earlier in the pandemic. But the people that are doing it still rate Chicago as an exceptional place to visit. Just how high are we on the list? It's pretty good. David Whitaker is going to join us, the president and CEO of Choose Chicago, in just a little bit to chat through that. And then later, Amy Guth going to break down some of the big stories. I know we're going to talk about Boeing making some headlines as well. All righty, John Hanson here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, 12:35 on this gorgeous Tuesday afternoon. Had some light clouds come through the area a bit ago, but they've cleared out of the way, and we're being greeted with a gorgeous fall day. Perfect day to talk about how great Chicago is, as opposed to some polar vortex day in a few months. Here to do that with us is David Whitaker, the president and CEO of Choose Chicago. David, some great news from Condé Nast.
John, thanks for having me on. And these are blue skies today, and a great day to announce this morning Condé Nast Travel, one of the top reputed travel publications, both online and magazine, Condé Nast Traveler. They do an annual Reader's Choice Awards. Over 715,000 people voted for their favorite cruise line, their favorite golf resort, their favorite island resort. They also have a category for favorite big U.S. city to visit. And I'm thrilled and just delighted to share. It's a real victory for the entire industry in hospitality and travel that for the fourth consecutive year in a row, which is really significant, mm-hmm. Chicago was voted as the number one best big U.S. city.
We're number one.
So it's really wonderful.
Yeah. All right. This is going to turn into a session of some self-love here, because I think everyone could always use it. I look at these rankings sometimes and I go, who cares? But the reality is that if a big publication does this, people that are considering where to do their next trip, I mean, this could be something that tips them over the edge. That means lots of bucks for the city.
Yeah, no, obviously, and I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that, you know, as we're celebrating this accomplishment, it's in the face of some real significant challenges for a lot of our entrepreneurs, a lot of our small businesses. But it really speaks to the potential of Chicago. It's a reaffirmation of what we always do and why for four consecutive years before COVID. It also lays a foundation, to your point, as people start thinking about getting back out again, they're going to want to go back to the things that they trust, the things that they love. And Chicago has proven that experience for them if 715,000 voters are accurate. And we know we are the largest convention town in North America. We know we have some of the most amazing restaurants and attractions and natural assets, and hospitality is at our core. So it's about connecting with visitors again. They need to feel safe. They need to feel healthy and safe and all the protocols we're going through. That's why it's going to be a measured reopening, because as we do, we want people to come back and have those experiences. But we want them to want to come back. And a vote like this, a reaffirmation, it feels good for us, and we should take that moment. But more importantly, because of the challenges we're facing, it's something to build upon as we slowly and strategically and responsibly start welcoming people back.
You teased a little bit of this, but I feel a little bit like Stuart Smalley staring in the mirror at this moment. But why do people love us so much?
Well, I mean, I think it's the variety of experiences equal to the variety of our visitors. I mentioned we're a number one convention town, but we're also the top restaurant city in the country. In fact, our chefs continue to be acknowledged both the famous chefs and then just the amazing food experiences, not just in our destination restaurants, but all in all of our amazing neighborhoods. Our art and culture, second to none. Our architecture being celebrated. In fact, this, in a few weeks, opened House Chicago again to get out and celebrate. We'll use that as part of this momentum-building experience. It's the variety of but at the core, what we know is when people come here, they feel welcome. They are able to be themselves and have a great, authentic experience. And that authenticity is going to be what will help us be true to our roots and our DNA as we convince visitors that this is their favorite destination. Come back and be with us again. We'll host you responsibly at the appropriate time.
This might be a dumb question. I'm never afraid of those, though, David. When I think about tourists in the city, you think of all the touristy places, and they're all very centrally located to downtown. And when I travel to other places, yeah, I go on the list, see what to see. It's always in the downtown area, it seems like. Do you guys at Choose Chicago make efforts to get people to travel to what I think is the real gems of our city, are the neighborhood spots, the places that are off the beaten path? I imagine you guys do what you can to try and get people to go everywhere they can in the city.
Well, shameless plug, but since you ask, you know, okay. I'm really proud of our website, choosechicago.com. We have a whole neighborhood section, you know, that features all 77. And in each of them, they have amazing, charming restaurants, artisans, Chicago-made businesses, small entrepreneurs, not just restaurants and music and theaters, but just the experience and the cultural diversity of some of our neighborhoods. So from top to bottom, that's a big selling point for us.
Yeah.
We get a lot of publicity around that. And in this trying time, as we get residents and nearby residents to start traveling again as a first core visitor, they don't want to do the been there, done that. They want to explore new, authentic experiences. And so the strength of our neighborhoods, there's not a better time for us to promote that as we connect again with our local and regional visitors. And then for the international visitor, they want to go, that's the new trend in all cities. They want to go off the beaten path. Where do the locals go? What's the trend? Look at the West Loop, what it was 10 years ago and what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
That's because people first started going there because it was new and exciting and everybody was talking about it, and they wanted to be the first person there. There's dozens and dozens of neighborhoods. Look what's happening in Pullman. The new food hall that just opened, some of the investments happening. Obviously, the presidential center will mm-hmm. be a huge boom for the south part of our community. So north, south, east, and west, there are tremendous opportunities, and never more is it more important to promote this authenticity and diversity of our city than right now when we have to be at our core authentic.
Absolutely. And I love the neighborhoods. I think that's our selling point and why, as you said, people will come back. And that's No shame to downtown, because we've got a lot of great things that I'm sure we've talked about many times before. All right, David Whitaker, President and CEO of Choose Chicago, congratulations. That's great news today.
Well, I can't promise a five-peat, but we're going to do everything we can to keep Chicago front of mind in the year to come.
Well,
thanks for this opportunity.
If we're Chicago, we should at least go for six. The Bulls did it. The Blackhawks have got six. You add up the baseball team World Series, I believe you get six as well. I'll have to check that math. But first, we're going to get a look at the Wintrust Business Minute. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Mayor Lightfoot is pushing back her 2021 budget address to October 21st. She was scheduled to give that on October 14th. Lightfoot says Chicago faces the largest budget gap in the city's history due to the overwhelming and persistent impacts of COVID-19. She's hoping Congress comes up with a new stimulus bill to help state and local governments before she gives the address. Ruth's Chris Steakhouse is leaving Chicago. The restaurant was temporarily closed because of the pandemic, and now its owners say the restaurant will not reopen. All 59 employees will be laid off. A Chicago pizza place that pivoted from food to face shields says pizza orders are bouncing back slightly. Demos Pizza shifted workers to making face shields for the pandemic and was making about 1,000 shields per week. Now that number is about 100 per week. During the height of the pandemic, the dining room at Demos was closed. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
John in for John. John will be back tomorrow. Hope that made sense. Amy Guth joins us now. Amy, good to chat with you again.
Hi, John. How are you?
Oh, very good. Hey, breaking news, Second City for sale.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the comedy force that is Second City, this is just now coming out that it is for sale. And, you know, we think of it as being the entertainment venue and a comedy school, but it's also in recent years branched into corporate partnerships and things like that. So it does a lot of stuff, but in a statement. The current owner and former CEO, Andrew Alexander, said that, hey, I've had a great run in the last 47 years with this amazing institution. But he said, you know, it's time for a new generation with fresh ideas to take the company to the next level. I should note, it is not the first time it's been for sale. It is the second time that it has been for sale in its 60-year history, according to them. So, you know, to me says, okay, no reason to panic. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be a totally different thing and we'll lose this beloved institution. It'll just change hands most likely.
Yeah.
So we'll see. This is brand new information. So we'll see, you know, who bites at that and what that looks like. But I think it'll be a very interesting thing to watch for sure.
Yeah. And sale doesn't mean leaving forever, as you just kind of alluded to. And I imagine the next buyer, although I don't want to speculate, will be someone who's passionate about the project that they've been passionate about. Hopefully.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Sale doesn't necessarily mean big changes. I think when we hear sale, we think, oh my gosh, they're going to change it completely. But, you know, we don't know. That might be someone who says, I want to preserve its legacy. I want to keep it exactly like it is. That may be someone who says, hey, we need to bring in more whatever, digital or something else. Who knows? So we'll see. But we just have to kind of wait and see, as with, I think, everything in the world right now. We have to just wait and see. But, you know, certainly big news. Second City is such a beloved institution here locally.
Yeah, me and you speculating. They can bring in more whatever. Suffice to say, me and you won't be buying it together. All right.
No.
let's talk about Boeing. I think this is news. You know, they're lowering expectations about demand for new planes. I don't think this is all that surprising, but it's still big news.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, as you know, I keep a very close eye on the airlines. Just with Boeing and United, both here in our backyard, of course. So Boeing, they've had a really tumultuous almost 2 years. You know, the 737 MAX has been grounded for 2 years in March. So that's quite a bit of time. They've had some whistleblower issues and the pandemic to contend with, during which air travel all but completely collapsed. So there has been speculation from various people in leadership positions, from air carriers, things like that, saying, hey, I don't think it's going to, you know, it's not just going to pop right back here. It's going to take a long time to recover. There's a lot of factors. So Boeing, they have said they've lowered their forecast 11%. And they're saying that the world will need just over 18,000 new commercial airplanes in the next decade. So that's 11% lower. And the value of the market will slide by about $200 billion from last year's forecast. That's a lot of optimism to lose in the span of 1 year, really. But when they're talking about comebacks, we had previously heard, you know, I think the most far-reaching speculation I had heard from anyone in the aviation industry was about 2024, 2025. Here's Boeing saying, we're not going to see a complete rebound until the 2030s, which... that's almost too hard to fathom. You know, they regularly do issue decade outlooks and kind of a 20-year outlook of kind of, here's what the aviation industry sort of looks like right now, here's what we predict. But there's so much, you know, uncertainty and speculation and just things we don't know right now, that they're really not looking, they're not feeling too optimistic in their reporting for right now.
Yeah, markets aren't either. Boeing down 5.4, 3.15% last time I checked. And, you know, it makes sense because, Amy, I mean, Boeing, it needs strong airlines to buy their product, and it's going to take time for the airlines themselves to recover, let alone buying and investing in new planes, especially when, you know, they're going to be cash-strapped, and a lot of their planes haven't been doing much. The length of the airplanes themselves, you know, these are done based on hours of flight. These are based on number of takeoffs and landings. The simple decrease in airline travel has probably extended the life of some of these planes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they said they expect near-term demand, rather, to be really weak for those wide-body aircraft. When we're talking about, like, two aisles in the main body of the aircraft, so we're going to see a lot smaller planes just because we're going to see a lot fewer people in the air. Now, interestingly, Airbus, who is Boeing's big rival, European plane maker, they were not going to look at the horizon like that. They're like, for sure, we're going to see some tumultuous years, but they really wouldn't go beyond 2025. They really just kind of didn't feel like they were going to, you know, speculate quite as much as Boeing. So of course, as I always say this every day, like, it remains to be seen. There's so much we don't know right now. We have to wait and see. But, you know, when airlines started coming out of the gate with, hey, this isn't going to be fast, this is going to be a long haul, that I think really caught a lot of analysts' attention. A lot of economists started watching that really, really closely. When you have the manufacturer even talking that way, that cannot be a heartening thing for airline carriers to hear when they're grappling with, you know, huge numbers of layoffs and furloughs that we saw earlier. So,
yeah. Airbus stock up 2.74%. Okay, edible arrangements. I'm sure we've all either gotten one or given one or been around someone. This story is wonderful. So they're getting into the green business a bit, and with that comes lawsuits about what the term edible is and who can use it.
That's exactly right. I had to do a double take. I had to reread this story several times when I first saw this emerge because I was like, wait, what? Indeed. So this really comes down to a debate over who owns the word edible. When we think of edible arrangements, okay, that's fruit cut up to look like a flower bouquet, sure. When we think of edibles, like gummy bears that may have marijuana in them.
Right.
So this lawsuit has been filed by Edible Arrangements. They're saying, hey, this is too confusing for us and for our franchisees. And in fact, we're going to get into the edibles business by offering a CBD, so not full marijuana, but CBD-laced candy in the near future. And we don't want disinformation, or we don't want confusion out there about this. Now, possibly the best quote that I have seen from a leader of an organization in quite a while came from Green Thumb Industries, which is a local company, a huge player in the marijuana space. He said, even those who have consumed a generous serving of our delicious Incredibles wouldn't confuse a pre-cut fruit bouquet delivery business with an edible cannabis brand, which I thought very funny.
Very true.
But, yeah, he went on to say, hey, this is a classic example of trademark overreach. Of course, Edible Arrangements files, you know, that's when they fired back and said, well, no, in fact, we are going to start selling CBD. So I think this will be a very interesting lawsuit to watch because who, in fact, owns the word edible? I think of that as just kind of a common word, as like bad food, not edible, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it will be interesting to see what the legal definition becomes and how a judge rules on this one.
Look, can't we just get these two parties together, have some edibles, chill out, relax, and hash this out?
Oh, I see what you did there.
I didn't even know I was going to get there till the end, and I was very happy the second one jumped on in there. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see exactly where this goes. I have another sheet here. I don't know if this is what you were going to talk about, too, but I know that Apple, obviously, having their big announcement. I don't know. Are you one of those people that's been holding out for a new phone, and they're really expecting this new announcement to be big news?
John, my phone is beyond help. I've got tape on it holding the screen. It's shameful. I would love to be one of those people that like always grabs the newest iPhone.
Yeah.
I am shamefully behind by several editions of phones. But nonetheless, Apple has announced an event this next week. It'll be on October 13th. All the speculation is that it will be a new phone with 5G capabilities. The only hint that they have dropped is in the invitation for the event. It just says high speed. That's it. So
wow.
A lot of people immediately kind of jumped on this idea that this is going to be this 5G phone. Now, Apple is interesting right now because normally they just have the one big event in September and start shipping phones in October. So to have this second event is, you know, they wouldn't do that unless they had pretty big news. So it won't just be like, hey, there's a new color of phone. It's going to be something
big. All right. Thank you, Amy, so much. Sorry we're out of time. Good to talk to you as always.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Quick commercial break, and then we'll wrap it up on WGN.